From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Nights of a Ghost Hunter. I am frequently asked to describe some of the night vigils I have kept, alone and with others, in haunted places. Such investigations, of course, even when they do produce a phenomenon, do not always provide a ready explanation for the haunting. That is to say, in many instances, the ghost cannot be identified and the incident nicely rounded off to everyone's satisfaction, as is invariably done in fiction. Therefore, a long list of isolated, unexplained incidents of ghostly footsteps, knockings, and fragmentary ghostly appearances would prove repetitive, if not tedious. But there are several among my nocturnal adventures which will serve to show the wide scope and interest of my investigations, and I will begin with a notable vigil kept by myself and others in a house near Wells, Somerset. The house had long borne a widespread reputation of being haunted. It was a low, rambling, medium-sized building with a fine old oak staircase and a number of equally pleasing oak-paneled rooms. It adjoined a churchyard and confronted a wooded park where deer wandered at large. The exact age of the house was not known, but I believe it was built about the beginning of the 18th century on the site of an ancient mansion. Among the various stories commonly told about the house was one concerning two brothers. The elder brother, it was said, visited the other in the house one day and was never seen afterwards, the general supposition being that he was murdered in what was now termed the haunted room and buried somewhere on the premises. There may, of course, be no truth whatever in the tradition, but some at least of the ghostly phenomena that from time to time took place there were popularly attributed to it. Another story claimed that long ago an old woman was crushed to death in a gateway on the estate by some member of the family, the deed being attributed either to revenge or to some sudden act of anger or folly. This again may be pure romance, but it was believed by people in the surrounding villages, and her ghost haunted the place periodically. Having obtained permission of the owners of the property to hold an all-night vigil there, I went to the house accompanied by two friends. Midnight found us in the deep, dark cellars of the building, adjoining the vaults of the old church. Overhead, the big clock boomed 12. An owl in some near tree hooted, and a far-off dog bayed the moon. In the circumstances, uncanny sounds all, they nevertheless failed to bring the ghost, and after remaining in the cellars for a few minutes longer, we adjourned to the haunted room. This room, one entrance to which faced a long corridor, possessed some peculiarities. Under the floor, for instance, was a deep cavity known as the priest's hiding hole, which communicated with another secret spot in various parts of the building. Also, in a line with each other across the center of the floor, some few feet apart, stood two curious pillars, and a second doorway led into what was styled a powder closet. We had brought chairs with us. I sat facing the window, and one of my companions faced the powder closet, while the other sat about midway between us. At my request, one had brought his dog and the other his camera. The shutters of the room were closed, so as to preclude any tricks of the moonlight, and we sat in absolute darkness. About 2 a.m., the dog began to whine and snarl, and almost directly afterwards, one of my companions cried out. Confronting us by the doorway leading into the corridor was a tall, luminous thing, in shape not unlike one of the pillars. It moved very slowly and, passing the door leading to the powder closet, went on at a snail's pace towards the window on the opposite side of the room. After it had gone some little distance, I addressed it, asking it to tell us who or what it was and why it was there. There was no reply. I then asked it to knock on the wall or floor, but again there was no response of any kind. One of my companions also asked it questions with the same negative result. Continuing to move, the thing kept approaching the window, and when close to it, abruptly disappeared. We all three saw the phenomenon simultaneously, and were all so gripped by it that my companion with a camera forgot to use it. Some months after this visit, I went to the house again, accompanied this time by three men, one of whom was a chartered accountant in Wells. It was September. The day had been sultry, and at about 11 o'clock, a thunderstorm accompanied by wind and rain broke out. As before, we had a dog and a camera with us. Having searched the house to satisfy ourselves that no one was concealed in it, we walked to the haunted room, and having, as before, closed the shutters, we sat down at some little distance from one another. As on the previous occasion, I faced the window. The night proved noisy. Outside, the thunder pealed incessantly, and the rain beat against the window panes, while the wind moaned and whistled dismally down the chimney. Inside, doors and windows jarred and rattled. During brief lulls in the storm, we occasionally heard footsteps, and we got the impression that someone or something was moving about stealthily in our midst. I was so convinced of this that every now and then I switched on my torch. Always, however, with the same result. My companions were all in their seats in attitudes of tense expectation, but nothing was to be seen moving. As time wore on and nothing further happened, we gradually dropped off to sleep, to be abruptly wakened by a loud, continuous ringing. For a minute or so, none of us could make out whence the sounds came, and then someone suggested it was the front doorbell. We then, in a body, went down the long corridor and the broad oak stairs into the hall, which in the gloom appeared immense, to the front door. "Who's there?" I called out, and much to my relief, a very human voice replied, "It's only me." It transpired that it was a friend of the accountant, who was so keen on joining in the ghost hunt that he had walked all the way from Bath, a distance of some miles. As he said, he was a skeptic and did not mind where he sat. I suggested he should sit in the corridor at the head of the main staircase. He readily agreed, and leaving him there, we retraced our steps to the haunted room. Again, a long wait, and then an excitement. This time it was caused by the man in the corridor suddenly crying out, "Help! Help!" We ran at once to his assistance, only to find it was a false alarm. Tired out with his long tramp, the accountant's friend had fallen asleep and had a nightmare. "I dreamed," he said, "that a tall figure came flying downstairs and, leaping over me, went bounding on into the room where I had left you all sitting." Now, this dream struck me as odd, because one of the ghosts said to haunt the house was a tall figure that bounded up and down the stairs and along the corridor in the manner described. However, the young man maintained that it was only a dream, and we returned to the haunted room, leaving him in the corridor. Another long wait, and then, as the clock struck 4, the accountant exclaimed, "I shall have to be going. I take it nothing will happen now, as it's morning. Besides, I have to be at the office at..." Here he stopped short, and then crying out, "Oh my God, what's that?" began to pant and gasp. Simultaneously, the dog with a snarl and then whined, and I saw in front of me a red rectangular light about 6.5 or 7 feet from the floor and in about the middle of the room. Another of the sitters cried out that he saw something too. I stood up and, addressing the red light, asked who and what it was. There was no reply. I said we had come there as friends
and asked if there was anything we could do for it. Still no reply. "If you can't speak," I said, "will you knock or rap on the floor or wall?" But still, there was no response. The accountant had now become so agitated that, fearing some harm might come to him if he was not brought round, I stopped and lighted a candle. The red light then instantly vanished. The man in the corridor, who, hearing voices and seeing the light on in our room, joined us, had seen nothing. The accountant, whom we besieged with questions, described what he had seen thus. It was a tall, luminous figure which seemed to emit a light from all over it. The body was covered with black and white streaks. Possibly it was a check suit. That I cannot say, for it was the face that arrested my attention most. It was very long and swarthy. The skin was drawn very tightly over the bones, which gave it a skull-like appearance. I saw no actual eyes, only large sockets which appeared to be aglow with light, but it gave me the impression of being intensely malevolent and antagonistic. The other of my companions, who had also seen the figure, described it in much the same way, but the third man in our original party, who was present when the phenomenon appeared, said he'd only saw a kind of luminous mist which seemed to move towards the spot where I sat and disappeared behind me. I asked the accountant if he could bear sitting in the dark again, and on his assenting, I blew out the candle. Almost directly I had done so, the dog growled, and I again saw a red light suddenly appear in the middle of the room. The accountant cried out immediately, "It's there! It's there! I can't stand it! Light the candle!" I at once switched on my torch, and the light vanished. No one felt inclined to remain in the room any longer. We now came away and were not at all sorry to find ourselves once more in the open rain and all. Now, to Lone Vigil. Learning while in Harrogate, Yorkshire, that there was an alleged haunted house in the town, I sought and managed to obtain permission to spend the night in it. It was a large, tall house situated about 10 minutes' walk from St. James Hall. I went there early on a summer's evening, and on entering the premises encountered a stillness which contrasted oddly with the world outside, where all was life and gaiety. Only a moment before I had mingled with the streams of ultra-fashionable people heading for the spa concert, the theater, and the valley park. The forsaken house was empty of furniture, of everything, save the soft summer evening sunlight, the shadows, and my presence. Wandering from room to room and floor to floor, I completed my preliminary search, and being tired, sat down on the floor of the hall, took a newspaper from my pocket, and started reading. As the hours passed by and darkness came on, I began to be afraid. No amount of experience in ghost hunting has ever enabled me to overcome the awful fear that seizes me when I see the last glimmer of daylight fade and realize that I am about to be brought into contact with the supernatural and must face it alone. Noises in empty houses, I have noticed, usually commence in the basement, and I was not at all surprised to hear a faint tapping proceeding from one of the kitchens. This was followed by a long spell of silence, and then one of the stairs creaked. My heart gave a thump, and I gazed expectantly into the darkness before me, but there was nothing to be seen. Silence again, and then moving, and more tapping, and more creaking. Something then tickled my hand, and a moment later my fingers touched a black beetle. In an instant I was on my feet, and on striking a light I found the whole floor swarming. I wondered very much at this, because beetles do not, as a rule, frequent houses that have been empty for any length of time, especially in a climate like that of Harrogate. I have since, however, arrived at the conclusion that where there are hauntings, there are, more often than not, plagues of beetles. but whether attracted by the ghost or not, I cannot say, as I could no longer tolerate the idea of remaining in the hall in the dark. I lighted 4 candles, placed them to form a big square on the floor, and sat in the midst of them. It was still only 7 o'clock by my watch, and the idea of keeping up my vigil till morning did not strike me as particularly pleasant. I took up my paper and again began to read. 30 minutes or so passed, and then I started in shocked surprise. A door opened and shut downstairs, and bare footsteps pattered their way along the stone passage and up the wooden stairs. The nearer they drew, the more intolerable became my suspense. What should I see? I confess, I would have given much to be out in the road, but as usually the case when in the presence of the supernatural, I was quite powerless to move. Then, to my astonishment, instead of anything grotesque and awful, there suddenly appeared before me a little fair-haired girl, clad in a much soiled pinafore, and without either shoes or stockings. Though not actually crying, the child appeared to be in great distress and feeling around on all sides, as if anxiously searching for someone. She ran past me and began to ascend the stairs. Picking up a candle, I followed her, and as the patterings of her poor, chilled feet spread their echoes far and wide through the deserted house, I thought I had never experienced anything half so pathetic. On and on we went, the little thin legs leading the way till we reached the top story, where she ran into a room facing me and slammed the door. I immediately threw open the door and followed, but the room was quite empty. There was no sign of the child, only a particularly vivid beam of moonlight and an overwhelming atmosphere of sadness. During the next few days, I was told a story that fully accounted for the hauntings. It appeared that about 30 years before my visit to the house, a little girl had lived there with her father and stepmother. Her nurse, to whom she was very much attached, being summarily dismissed by her stepmother, she became ill and very soon died, so it was rumored of a broken heart. Shortly after her death, the house was to let, and no tenant, I discovered, had ever occupied it for very long. I have often wished that I had spoken to the sad little spirit, but I was too fascinated by it and too much engaged in watching its movements to think of anything else, and I have found that the same fascination and preoccupation have prevented me from trying to communicate with a ghost in nearly all the cases of haunting that I have ever investigated. On the few occasions that I have spoken to a ghost, I have received no reply, little indication even that it had heard me. In a very famous haunted house in the west of England, during my investigations, which were spread over a period of 9 consecutive nights, manifestations took place twice, and on both occasions I stood up and spoke, but in neither case was there any response whatever. The same ghost had been subjected to exorcism by a well-known ecclesiastic, but far from being exorcised, the ghost so scared its exorciser that he all but fainted. These demonstrations were visual. In a haunted house that I was asked to visit in Sussex, I saw nothing but heard knockings, and by means of them tried, though without success, to establish a code. I heard of the case in this way. Miss Maureen Denning wrote to me. She and her mother occupied a modern and picturesquely situated house at the foot of the Downs, and were very frequently disturbed, she said, between 9 and 10 in the evening, by sounds such as might be a muffled hammer on the wall of her mother's room. Simultaneously, the figure of a young man was seen to move noiselessly across the lawn from the direction of the garden swing. He usually approached Mrs. Denning's window and came to a halt immediately beneath it. He had never replied when spoken to. She possessed a revolver and had fired at him several times, but the bullets had no effect whatever. It seemed as if they had passed right through him, because he still stood there, while the gravel was splattered up immediately behind him. On one or two occasions, Miss Denning told me The man shone a bicycle lamp on his face so that she could distinctly see his features. It was a face of no one she knew, though she fancied it bore a close resemblance to a notorious murderer whose photos had been in the papers and who had been executed. These were not the only manifestations. Stones had been repeatedly thrown at Mrs. Denning, and although the house was being closely watched by the police, the stone throwing still went on, and so far the culprit had not been seen, let alone caught. The stones, though, were solid, real, and hurtful enough. In response to the daughter's appeal, I visited the house once by myself and once with a party of men. On the former occasion, I hid in a little copse at the farthest extremity of the lawn and watched the house and swing closely, but I neither heard nor saw anything. Returning to the house, I was told by Miss Denning that both she and her mother had heard the knockings and that she herself had, at the same time, seen the figure on the lawn. On the occasion of my second visit, we all heard the knockings on the door of Mrs. Denning's room, and one of us was looking out of her daughter's window, saw what he thought were two shadows of human beings cross the moonlight lawn and vanish in the direction of a hedge. Trickery was impossible, as the garden was protected on all sides by barbed wire, and there were on the premises four or five dogs, including a young bloodhound. We had, of course, made a thorough search of the house and grounds previously. One or two other incidents happened during the night. When I was in the hall alone, a light, as from a bicycle lamp, was suddenly shone in my face, apparently from the blank wall. And when we were all seated in front of the dining room fire, we heard heavy footsteps cross the hall. Although we ran out at once, we could see no one. We were shown the stones that were alleged to have been thrown. None was thrown while we were there. They were a peculiar kind of flint, which certainly did not belong to the neighborhood. Mrs. Denning had several times narrowly escaped being hit by them, and one had crashed through the bedroom window as she was looking out of it. I would have liked to have spent more time investigating this baffling case, but this was not possible. Cases of complex haunting, although seldom admitting of any satisfactory explanation, have always attracted me most. Here, for instance, is one I chanced to come upon in Newcastle upon Tyne. A house in D Street had stood empty for 7 or 8 years, and on my making inquiries about its reputedly sinister reputation, I was told to contact a Mr. Black, the last tenant. I did so, and Mr. Black once assured me of my serious interest, gave me a detailed account of what had taken place there during his tenancy. This was his statement. A day or two after our arrival, I happened to be going upstairs, and as I passed by one of the bedrooms, the door of which was slightly open, I glanced in and saw the figure of a woman I had never seen before. She was dressed in green and standing in front of the mirror, engaged apparently in putting on her hat. Wondering who on earth she could be, for I knew the room had not been slept in, I spoke to her, and receiving no reply, I was advancing towards her when she suddenly disappeared. I did not know what to make of the affair, but thinking that possibly it was hallucination, I resolved to think no more of it and to say nothing about it to any of my family or household. Some days later, however, when out walking with my wife, I met a friend who asked me where I was living. I told him, and he exclaimed excitedly, "Good gracious, not in that house! Why, my dear fellow?" At a hasty sign from me, he then stopped. I had guessed what was coming, and as my wife's extremely nervous, I thought it best she should not hear what I knew he was going to say, namely, that the house was haunted. That night, I went round to see my friend. He made no bones about it. He told me that the house I had taken was haunted, that he knew it for a fact. "Some months ago," he said, "I was thinking of taking it myself, and obtaining the key from the agent, went to have a look over the place. It was quite light, not more than 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and the house seemed bright and cheerful. Closing the front door behind me, I began a tour of the premises. I had reached the top floor and was standing in the center of one of the rooms when I heard a slight noise. I started and, turning around in the direction from which the sound came, saw a woman and a little girl standing in the doorway watching me. There was nothing at all remarkable about them. The woman was dressed in green, the child in white, both modern, or at least comparatively modern, costumes. I was so surprised at their being there, however, as I knew I had shut the hall door, that I simply stood and stared at them. Then something much more extraordinary happened. They vanished. It was not a hallucination, that I can swear to, and thoroughly scared, I tore downstairs and out of the house. After this, I gave up all idea of taking the place, and I can't help feeling sorry, old fellow, that you've taken it. In spite of my friend's warning, Mr. Black continued, I did not give up the house immediately. After we had been there a week or so, a cousin of mine came to stay with us, and one evening, he and one of my children, my young daughter, were in the drawing room, where they heard a soft, cautious whistle, as if someone were giving a signal, coming from just behind them. The whistle was repeated, and a few minutes later, they heard a loud cry, half human, half animal, and wholly ominous. My cousin pretended that it was one of the servants, but my daughter would not be convinced and begged to be taken up to bed at once, so she dared not remain in the room any longer. After this, phenomena of all kinds happened. Steps used to be heard bounding up and down the stairs at all hours of the night. One of the maids declared she saw something that was a man, and yet not a man, come out of the drawing room with a run and race up the staircase two or three steps at a time. Heavy pantings and sighs were heard, and several of the household were awakened by a cold hand being laid upon their face. But I think the most remarkable thing that happened is this. I was sitting in my study one evening when the maid rapped at my door and said that a clergyman, whom she had shown into the drawing room, wished to see me on some very urgent matter. I at once put down the book I was reading, and hastening to the drawing room, found it empty. Wondering what had become of the clergyman, I was about to ring the bell to inquire when I suddenly caught sight of a large eye, human in shape and horribly sinister, glaring at me from behind an armchair. I was so frightened that I could do nothing but stare back at it. And then, to my intense relief, my wife entered the room with a friend, and the phenomenon disappeared. And the parson? I asked. I never heard anything more of him, said Mr. Black. The maid assured me on her honor that she had shown him into the room, but no one saw him leave the house, so he too might have been a ghost. However, supposing him to have been a living person, his disappearance would not be unnatural. He had doubtless seen the eye and taken to the street through the open window. The following day, my children, being badly frightened by something in one of the passages, I decided to leave the house at once. I afterwards made every possible inquiry, but could not discover anything tragic in the history of the house. We were the first tenants, so I was told, that had ever complained of disturbances, and it was suggested that we might have brought ghosts with us. But as none of us had ever seen a ghost before we entered the house, and we had no old furniture, at least none that Wood had not always had, and not one of us had ever attended a seance or in any way dabbled with spiritualism, I don't think that theory holds water at all. I would have liked to have sat vigil in this house of the lady in green, but it was not possible at the time. However, I had better luck with a house in Glasgow. While passing through that city, I heard of such a promising case of haunting there that I was unable to resist the temptation of investigating it, and decided to break my journey. The case as outlined to me in the first instance was this. A Glasgow solicitor named James McKay, desirous of renting a house close to his office, went one morning to look at a likely place in Duke Street. He went there alone, and closing the front door behind him, proceeded to wander from room to room, beginning with the basement. As he was going upstairs to the first floor, he suddenly heard footsteps following him. He turned sharply round, but there was no one there. Thinking this odd, but attributing it to the acoustic properties of the walls, he continued up the stairs. Having arrived on the first landing, he went into one of the rooms. The steps followed him. A brilliant notion then occurred to him. He stamped his foot, but there was no answering echo. He turned and went into the next room, and the footsteps once again accompanied him. It was at this point that he grew frightened. It was broad daylight. The sun shone brilliantly, and the birds were singing, but there was something in the house that was wrong. The day was hot, and the sun poured in through the blindless windows, but in spite of this, the rooms were icy, and McKay was deliberating whether it was worthwhile exploring the house further when he caught sight of a shadow on the wall. It was not his own shadow. It was that of a man with his arm stretched out horizontally on either side of him, and whereas the right arm was complete in every detail, the left had no hand. James McKay now yielded to an ungovernable terror and rushed frantically out of the house. One would naturally think that after all this, he would have vowed never to go near the place again. Nothing of the sort. The house fascinated him. He could not get it out of his mind. He even dreamed of it as having some mystery that he must solve, that only he could solve. Besides, he argued with himself, there was not another house in the city so conveniently situated nor so cheap. Consequently, he took it, and within a fortnight had moved in with all his family and household goods. For the first few weeks, everything went swimmingly, and McKay congratulated himself on having made such an excellent bargain. Then occurred an incident which recalled sharply the day he had first seen the place. He was writing some letters one morning in his study when the nursemaid entered, white and agitated. "Oh, do come to the nursery, sir," she implored. "The children are playing with something that looks like a dog and yet isn't one. I don't know what it is." And she burst into tears. McKay sprang to his feet and ran upstairs. On reaching the nursery, the blurred outline of something like a huge dog or wolf came out of the half-open door and raced past him, so close that he distinctly felt it brush against his clothes. Where it went, he could not say. He was thinking of the children and did not stop to look. Oddly enough, the children were not a bit afraid. On the contrary, they were pleased and curious. "What a strange doggie it was, Daddy," they cried. "It never wagged its tail like other doggies, and whenever we tried to stroke it, it slipped away from us. We never touched it once." Sorely puzzled, McKay told his wife, and the two decided that if anything further happened, they must leave the house. That night, McKay happened to sit up rather late. At last, he rose from his chair and was about to turn off the gas when he felt his upstretched hand suddenly caught hold of by something large and soft, which did not seem to have any fingers. He was so frightened that he yelled out, whereupon his hand was instantly released and there was a loud crash overhead. Thinking something had now happened to his wife, he rushed upstairs to find her sitting up in bed and talking in her sleep. She was apparently addressing a black shadowy figure that crouched on the floor opposite her. As McKay approached the thing, it moved towards the wall and vanished. Mrs. McKay then awoke and begged her husband to take her out of the house at once, as she had dreamed most vividly that an appalling murder had been committed there, and that the murderer had come out of the room with outstretched hands, asking her to look at them. McKay, who had had quite enough of it, too, promised to do as she wished, and before 24 hours had passed, the house was once again empty. These were the bare facts of the case, and as they were given to me by one of his important clients, I had no difficulty in obtaining an interview with Mr. McKay, who, I was told, still had the keys of the house. It was not, however, so easy to obtain his consent to spend the night on the premises, and he would only permit me to do so on the condition that for safety's sake he himself accompanied me, and that I promised to keep the visit a secret from the newspapers. The evening chosen for our enterprise proved ever memorable. The rain came down in torrents, and the high wind made any attempt to hold up an umbrella utterly impossible. Indeed, it was as much as I could do to hold myself up, while to add to my discomfort, at almost every step I plunged ankle-deep in icy cold puddles. At length, drenched to the skin, I arrived at the house. McKay was standing on the doorstep, swearing furiously. He could not, he said, find the key. However, he found it shortly after I arrived, and we were soon standing inside, shaking the water from our clothes. This was in the days before pocket flash lamps had become general, and we had to be content with candles. We each lighted one, and at once began to search the premises to make sure no one was in hiding. The house consisted of 4 stories and a basement. None of the rooms was very large, and I remember the wallpaper was singularly unlovely. McKay asked me if I could detect anything peculiar in the atmosphere, but I could only detect extreme mustiness, and told him so. He seemed very fidgety and ill at ease, but as he was much older man than myself, and had some experience of the house, I felt perfectly safe with him. After we had been in all the rooms, we went downstairs to the ground floor and began our vigil on the staircase leading from the hall to the first landing. I think we stand more chance of seeing something here than anywhere else, McKay said, and in the case of anything very alarming happening, we are close to the front door. He spoke only half in fun, and I saw that his fingers twitched a good deal and that his eyes were never at rest. "Aren't we to put out the candles?" I said. Ghosts, as a rule, materialize much more readily in the dark. But he would not hear of it. All his experiences in the house, he said, had taken place in the light. He then began to describe to me once more all that had happened during his occupation of the house. He was still telling me when there came a loud rat-tat at the door. "That's a policeman," he said. "He must have seen our light." He was right, for when we opened the door, a burly figure in helmet and cape stood on the steps and flashed his dripping bullseye lantern in our faces. On hearing McKay's name, the constable's suspicions instantly cleared, and when we mentioned ghosts, he laughed out long and hard. "Well, gentlemen," he said, "you won't never be alarmed by an apparition so long as you have that dog with you. I bet he would scare away any number of ghosts, and burglars, too. If I may be so bold as to ask, what breed do you call him? I've never seen anything quite like him before." And he waved his lamp towards the stairs. We both looked in the direction he indicated, and there, halfway up the stairs, with its face apparently turned towards us, was the black shadowy outline of some shaggy creature, which to me looked not so much like a dog as a bear. It remained stationary for a moment or so, and then retreating backwards seemed to disappear into the wall. "Well, gentlemen, good night," the policeman said, lowering his lamp. "It's time I was going." He turned on his heel and was walking off when McKay called him back. "Wait a moment, constable," he said, "and we'll come with you." He cast a furtive glance round him as he spoke. Then, blowing out the lights, he caught me by the arm and dragged me away. "But the dog, sir," the policeman said, as the front door closed behind us with a bag. "It hasn't come out." "And it never will," McKay responded grimly. "You have seen the ghost, constable, or at least one of them." I never had a second opportunity of visiting the house, and for all I know to the contrary, it still stands there and is still haunted. One lone vigil, which I kept at a house near Maidstone in the late 1920s, produced not the ghost I expected, but something uncannily different. The house had a history. About 1812, the owner of it went on a visit to some friends, leaving 2 women servants in the house to look after it. Fearing burglars and thinking to outwit them, if they did not break in, the 2 women hid all the silver in the house in the kitchen oven. However, one of them, in a fit of absent-mindedness, lit the kitchen fire, and the silver was very badly damaged. They were then, it seemed, so fearful of the consequences servants in those days being treated so severely that they drowned themselves in a lake in the grounds. Afterwards, a beautiful avenue leading to this lake acquired a lasting reputation for being haunted. A year or two before my investigation, a lady visitor at the house was found lying in the avenue in a dead faint. On recovering consciousness, she told a strange tale. She said that as she was walking up the avenue, she suddenly saw a woman clad in a very old-fashioned dress and wearing a kind of mob cap approach her. As they drew nearer to one another, she saw the woman's face very distinctly, and it was so horrible that she fainted. After this, various other people saw the same figure, always in the avenue, but not always at the same time. It sometimes appeared in broad daylight. A man who saw it one afternoon preceding him up the avenue, its back to him, thought at first it was merely some eccentrically clad member of the household, but later, when he heard about the haunting, he was convinced from the description given him of it that he had actually seen the ghost. With these stories fresh in my mind, I settled to a nocturnal vigil in the avenue and grounds of the house one autumn evening, and I must confess, I did not altogether enjoy it. Though the weather was fine and the air very sweet and fresh after London, there was a loneliness about the place which I found exceedingly depressing. The feeling of eeriness was worse by the water. There was a ghostly glimmer on it, and I could feel something beside me, something bizarre and evil, that had its home there was doing its utmost to persuade me to throw myself in. Indeed, so strong a fascination did that black silent pool exercise over me that it took a great effort of will power to drag myself away from it and return to the avenue. On my coming to a part where several paths met, I was deliberating which one of them to take when I heard footsteps pattering along one of the paths towards me. They came very rapidly, as if someone were in a great hurry, but I could see nothing. When they were close to me, I instinctively drew back to let them pass by, but all the same, I felt someone bump into me. The footsteps then went on and gradually died away in the distance. I walked about the avenue for some time after that, but nothing further happened. What I had heard and felt was a ghost. There was no doubt of it, but whether it was the same ghost that other people had seen, and which, on this occasion, had chosen against manifesting itself visually, I cannot say. I suppose about 3/4 of my night vigils have been held alone. Others I have held with various sitters, ranging from owners and tenants of properties to notable people interested in my investigations, like the late Duke of Newcastle, Lord Curzon of Kettleston, Sir Ernest Bennett, and that fine old actor G. Aubrey Smith. These occasions always produced an assorted bag. One evening in the summer of 1924, for instance, I held watch at a flat in London accompanied by a party which included Miss Myra Smith, a lady bookie, Miss Lucy Shanahan, a skilled dress designer, and Mr. P.T. Selbit of St. George's Hall fame. The flat was in Redcliffe Square, South Kensington. The woman owner, believing it to be haunted, had invited me to spend an evening there and to bring as many friends as I could with me. Prominent among my companions, besides those mentioned, was Colonel Harvey Wexford, an old friend of mine. The owner of the flat, having also invited several of her friends, including a spiritualist medium, we formed one of my largest ever sittings. For some time we sat listening to the medium, whose efforts were disappointing. And when midnight drew near, we all went into the kitchen to see if we could get any better results from table turning, the most suitable table being in there. We had been waiting in vain for half an hour or so, and the medium was talking to Mr. Selbit, while the rest of the sitters chatted quietly with each other, when Miss Myra Smith, looking startled, whispered to me that she could see a tall figure in the doorway. I looked across at once, and there, as she had said, was a tall figure standing in the entrance to the kitchen. It was dressed in long, black, flowing robes, and had something that resembled a top hat on its head. Miss Shanahan, who was sitting next to me, saw the figure too, but none of us could see its face, as there was no light in front of it, and only a dim light in the passage behind it. Our seeing this figure caused some consternation, and on some member of the party turning on the electric light, the apparition vanished. Miss Myra Smith said that although she did not see the figure's face very distinctly, she was sure it was looking at Colonel Wexford, who was sitting next to her. A few days later, Colonel Wexford died quite suddenly. Now, what makes this case especially interesting is what I learned from Colonel Wexford a few weeks before the sitting at which this strange figure was seen. The colonel told me that when he was in Tibet many years before, a lama had prophesied the dates upon which he and a friend who was with him would die. In my friend's case, the prophecy had proved correct, he said. But, he went on laughingly, although the fellow hit it off right regarding my friend, I think he'll prove wrong about me, for according to him, my time is almost up. I am about to die this year, but I have never felt better in my life. The conversation, of course, came back to me the moment I was told of the colonel's death, and then I asked a friend who had traveled in Tibet and India to give me a description of the lama's dress. He did so, and commented quite without any question from me that the usual headdress of a lama was not unlike a top hat, whence, taking all the circumstances into consideration, I cannot help thinking that the figure that Miss Smith, Miss Shanahan, and I saw that night in the haunted flat was the spirit of the lama who had prophesied Colonel Wexford's death. Footsteps are very common phenomena in hauntings. Some years ago, I went to investigate disturbances of this nature said to occur in the top flat of a house near Selridge. Several people, including Mr. Arthur Sinclair, the popular Irish actor, accompanied me, and we stood at midnight on the staircase waiting for the ghost. After being there for some time, we heard footsteps ascending the stairs. They passed by several of us at very close quarters, and the banisters creaked ominously as if some heavy weight were being pressed against them. But none of us saw anything, and nothing further happened. This case sounds trivial enough now, when I came to put it down in writing, but at the time the footsteps actually heard ascending that long, winding staircase in the darkness of that big, deserted house certainly awoke a very real sense of fear. Not long ago, I investigated a more complex case in a flat near Theobald's Road, Holborn. The owner of the flat told me that in the dead of night, he had frequently heard footsteps ascend the main staircase of the house and halt outside his front door. Sometimes he would hear them cross the floor of his sitting room, enter his bedroom, and approach his bed. Usually nothing further happened, but on one or two occasions he had felt hands on the bedclothes. Beginning at his feet, they felt their way stealthily up his body towards his head. I asked if he ever saw anything, and he said, "No. I was in such a fright that I ducked my head under the clothes and kept it covered up till I heard the steps go away." Once a friend who was staying with him did see something. Hearing a noise in the sitting room, the friend got out of bed and on opening the sitting room door saw a strange man with a handkerchief bound round the lower part of his face, walk across the room, and without making any attempt to open it, pass right through the front door. These were the main phenomena. I held several sittings in the flat, but only on one occasion experienced anything I could not satisfactorily explain on natural grounds. I had two friends with me. One had stationed himself in the bedroom, and the other, a house agent, on the landing facing the main staircase of the building. I was alone on a bend on the stairs. We did not begin our vigil till about 1 o'clock, when the house was absolutely still and everyone in it had gone to bed. After chatting with the agent for some time, I was beginning to nod, for I was very tired, when something roused me, and directly afterwards I heard footsteps on the staircase immediately beneath me. They sounded muffled, as if someone in bare or stocking feet was trying to disguise them. On and on they came, right up to where I was standing, and then halted. I switched on my torch, but nothing was to be seen. The agent had heard the steps, too. He received the impression that the author of them was some very gross person who was muffling them on purpose. He was emphatic that the sounds could not be attributable to the acoustic properties of the house, and he was very much an expert in his field. I also heard ghostly footsteps in a house in Red Lion Square. W.G., though this was not the result of a vigil. I happened to be sharing the upper part of the house with a friend at the time. He was away, and one summer evening I was sitting in my bedroom, which was on the top floor, quite alone in the house. The two floors immediately beneath the flat were let out as offices, and so were unoccupied after 6 o'clock. A caretaker, his wife and daughter, lived in the basement, but on this occasion, as I learned afterwards, they were out. So I was, indeed, on my own. It was a beautiful evening in May. The sunshine came pouring into my bedroom through the open windows, and the square resounded with the discordant shouts of children using the square's garden as a playground. I was listening to them when I suddenly heard heavy footsteps on the uncarpeted stairs outside. The staircase was a very fine one of black oak. The footsteps came slowly and wearily up, suggesting to my mind some old and decrepit man. I wondered who it could be, as I was not expecting any visitors, and I sat and listened till the steps crossed the landing immediately below me and began to ascend the staircase leading to my room. I then got up and, going out of the room, looked downstairs. To my surprise, I saw no one. As I stood there, wondering what had become of the person, the steps suddenly began to descend. I followed just behind them, right down to the ground floor, and then along the passage to the front door, where they abruptly ceased. At the time, I had no idea the house was known to be haunted, but I afterwards heard that the caretaker's daughter had often seen the ghost of an old man on the staircase and in various other parts of the building. Also, the people who took the flat after my friend and I had vacated it told me they several times heard mysterious footsteps on the staircase, and that on one occasion a very strange thing had happened. A young man who was visiting them, seeing a strange old man coming up the stairs, spoke to him and asked him what he wanted. Whereupon the old man replied, "Oh, that's all right," and turning round, walked slowly down. Thinking this rather odd, the visitor followed him and saw him suddenly and inexplicably disappear in the passage leading to the front door. As far as I could ascertain, no tragedy was known to have occurred in the house, but as it was probably 150 years old, some unknown and undiscovered crime may have been committed there. At the same time, hauntings can arise from a dozen and one causes, and contrary to popular belief, they are by no means always due to acts of violence. In the case of another haunted flat in central London, I held what might be termed an extended vigil, inasmuch as I promptly rented it and moved in and lived there in an attempt to probe its mystery. It happened this way. Two women occupied a flat in Bloomsbury near the British Museum. One of them was in the habit of attending seances, and from hearing or imagining she heard knockings and spirit voices at seances, she took to hearing or imagining she heard them in the flat. She said the voices were those of her friends who had passed over, and that they wanted her to join them on the other side. Eventually, when her friend was away for a time, she did attempt to obey the voices in her own unhappy fashion. She locked herself in her bedroom, and some time later, someone staying in the house, smelling gas strongly on the landing outside the woman's room, told the landlord. He went for a policeman, and together they forced the door open and found the woman lying dead on her bed. After this, the flat stood empty till I heard of the case and rented the premises. I slept in the room where the tragedy occurred for some weeks, but only occasionally had experiences which I could say for certain were due to ghostly causes. They all happened while I was alone in the flat. For example, On two successive mornings, I awoke at the same hour, about 4 o'clock, to feel a sharp tug at the bedclothes covering my right shoulder. On both occasions, I looked round at once, but saw nothing. Yet I felt sure something was there, close beside me, trying to get into communication with me. Several times, when about to enter the flat in which I lived alone, I heard sounds like footsteps inside and could have sworn that some presence was on the other side of the door listening. No one took the flat after I left, and the whole house was later converted for use as business premises. Oddly enough, it is not always an abundance of phenomena that makes one of my vigils memorable. Sometimes the incident has been slight, yet at the time very impressive. I am reminded of what occurred the night before the Delphic Club transferred its quarters from Regent Street to German Street. As several of the members declared that they had had uncanny experiences in the old quarters, I resolved to do a night's vigil there before the removal took place. Two women members of the club volunteered to join me, and the three of us met there and sat in the hall, or rather on the landing, for the club occupied the third and fourth stories, and its premises were not self-contained. Our sitting began at about 11 o'clock. In rather more than an hour's time, during an interval of silence we had been talking, we heard a click in one of the rooms, and the electric light in the room was suddenly switched on. That was all. In the dead of night, however, and in a building empty save for myself and my two companions, it had a decidedly eerie effect and brought our vigil to an abrupt end. As a ghost hunter, one must be sympathetic but skeptical, more vigilant and skeptical, in fact, than the stoutest non-believer. Only by working in this way can one reduce extraordinary happenings to the basic evidence and weigh it accordingly. I must say here that I sympathize with those people who cannot bring themselves to entertain the very idea of there being such thing as ghosts. I am of the opinion that one can learn more from one spontaneous ghostly manifestation in a haunted house than from 1,000 lectures or 1,000 books. Experience really is the only medium of conviction. In spite of the widely diverse and complex hauntings in my own files, I have from time to time expressed my frank disbelief at a particular incident, only to be corrected later. I give a chastening example of this. At one time, when as a result of some particular investigation I was getting a flood of letters, a woman in Liverpool wrote to me, saying that her daughter Emily was tormented by a man coming into her bedroom every night at the same time and walking off with her bedclothes. The man said nothing, merely opened the door, and approaching the bed on tiptoe, caught hold of the clothes and hurriedly retreated with them. Spirit lights, my correspondent added, were constantly seen in the room, and at times figures like angels, and she would be glad if I would visit the house and discover for her, if possible, some explanation of the occurrences. The nature of the manifestations being somewhat extraordinary, I thought it advisable to take a friend. The house was in a crescent close to Clayton Square. We were shown into the drawing room, where all the family were assembled, and were at once regaled with detailed accounts of all that was alleged to happen. Then we were taken to the bedroom that was haunted, and the young woman, whose bed the ghost stripped, sat there with us at our request. As soon as the electric light was switched off, she began to see spirit lights, but we saw nothing. No man appeared. On taking our departure, my companion and I agreed that the phenomena were subjective and that it was simply a case of hallucination. Accordingly, I advised the girl's mother to consult a doctor, as in all probability her daughter needed a tonic and a change of air. Well, I returned to London and thought no more of the matter for a good 12 months, when quite by chance I ran across a young doctor to whom I had mentioned the incident. After the pleasantries, he said right away, "Elliot, you remember that Liverpool case you told me about, the case of the girl whose bedclothes used to disappear and which you thought was a hallucination? Well, you were mistaken. Since I saw you, I have become acquainted with the doctor who now attends her, and he told me that while he was there one day, the bedroom door opened and in walked a young man. He says the girl immediately exclaimed, Here is the man who haunts my room at night. For goodness sake, doctor, do something. Whereupon the man, muttering some words in German, abruptly left the room. My doctor friend immediately ran after him, but he had vanished. The house was searched at once, and no trace of him could be found. Now, what do you think of that case?